When a how-to book makes it to the second or the third edition, I'm impressed. It suggests that it's not just today's gimmick to be replaced by yesterday's fad, like a fad diet. But when a book makes it to the sixth edition, I'm particularly intrigued. And especially, frankly, if it's published by a major publisher. These days, one of the main purposes of a publisher is to be a curator. There is now, because it is so easy to publish books, self-publish books on, you know, Amazon's CreateSpace, which is a fabulous service, but it does put out zillions of books out there, that it's very hard for the consumer, other than thanks to wonderful Amazon reviews, which help, but it's very hard for readers, potential book buyers or book readers, to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so major publishers tend to serve that function because they do get thousands of books a year, and they have professionals review them, not just the editors, but I know when I submit my books, they get sent out to content area experts. So if a book is published by a major publisher and makes it to a sixth edition, I am particularly intrigued. And that is the case with the book The First Time Manager, which, while aimed at new managers, has plenty of lessons for all of us. And because my wife, as the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, does a fair amount of managing, I thought I would have her read it, and then she and I would discuss it. So, Dr. Barbara Nemko, tell me something from the book that you learned.
Well, we know that everybody says that you should listen more and talk less. For those of us who love to talk, that's easier said than done. And so I think some of the suggestions that are given in this book are really easy to do, and if you just keep them in mind, it will help. One of them is there are some things you can say, comments that you can make that will keep the person talking and you quiet, such as, "That's interesting. Tell me more. Why do you suppose he or she did that? Why do you feel that way?" I know to you, because you're a wonderful interviewer, those come naturally, but to many of us, they don't, and that's because we're all too busy thinking about what we're going to say rather than what the other person is saying.
Okay. Anything else about the... I have found, you know, I have invoked, and I've taught both to my clients and listeners to the show, what I call the traffic light rule. That during the first, you know, 20 or 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is green, people are listening, they pay attention. During the second 20, 30 seconds, they're, you know, the listener is perhaps beginning to wonder whether you'll shut up because they have something they want to say or whatever. And certainly after the first 40 to 60 seconds, your light's red, you rarely want to run the red light, they're probably ready for you to shut up, you don't want to think of your blabbermouth. And I've told that to a million of my clients, and every single client says it's a good idea. But most of them are unable to follow through. Even when I break it down and say, why don't you practice? You may not have a sense of what time is. Take a kitchen timer and practice talking for 20 seconds and see how much gets said in 20 seconds or 40 seconds. People find it really hard. Whether it be from the book or not, Barbara Nemko, do you have any suggestions as to how to help a chatterbox person, a long-winded person, realize that his or her, quote, the things he says it's ostensibly fascinating really is not fascinating and ends up costing you far more than you gain?
I think when you are engaged in what somebody is saying, you tend to show that with your body language. And so you're nodding, you're making eye contact. When you're not engaged, if you are looking away, that should be a hint to the other person that maybe they've gone on too long, or an interruption. There are some people who will go on for 5 minutes without a breath, and then the only thing to do is interrupt.
Here's where, at least my current thing at the moment, just in our having our conversation here, I think people don't realize how devastating an effect on themselves being a blabbermouth is. The kind of person who is so self-absorbed or think what he or she is saying is so fascinating is all about him or her. If they were other-directed, if they were a more balanced person, they wouldn't be talking at such great length. So I think you have to try to cure them by appealing to their selfish self-interest. If they realize that indeed the other person, when they are going beyond 40 seconds or a minute, the other person is thinking of them as a blabbermouth, long-winded, chatty Cathy, whatever it is, and that is devastating. Whether you're a salesperson trying to close a sale, you really should be listening more than talking. Whether you are whether you're in a personal relationship, whether you're working with your colleagues, talking with your boss, talking to your supervisees, if you are talking more than about 50 or 60% of the time and keeping it in short bursts, you are hurting your career big time, and even in your personal relationships. So lest I go on too long, what's your reaction to that?
I think you're right, and I think that belongs during the period of time that you're evaluating the employee, if that's what we're talking about. But clearly, this is an issue that goes well beyond just your employment status, because as you said, this has to do with all of your relationships and how you're perceived when you go to a party.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, one of the things that I have really come to believe is that formal evaluations that occur once a year or twice a year tend to be rife with defensiveness because your salary depends on it. I'm a huge believer in managing by walking around. That's the kind of thing, if I am a manager and I am walking around and talking to, I like touching, notwithstanding all the strictures.
Danger, I know.
Well, screw it. You know, at some point I can't live my life worrying about litigation. But if I'm walking around and I, you know, in a very, of course, asexual way, put my hand on someone's shoulder for a moment and say, how are things going? Then at that point, if they go on at long length, there is a just-in-time opportunity to point out the traffic light rule so that it's not as fraught as if it would be in an informal evaluation situation. What do you think about that?
The nice part of doing it in the context of the evaluation is that's a really good time that you can appeal to the person's motivation. Everybody is motivated differently. Some people want a promotion. Some people want more money. Some people just want to keep their job. But any one of those motivations would be a good reason that you might want to say, you know, one of the things that you may want to consider, because I know you are looking for a promotion, is that it's very important for managers to listen more and talk less.
Okay.
And I think that might be more motivating to them than just you're walking around and you tell them that they talk too much.
Yep, I can see that. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, and we are I'm talking with my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and we are discussing the book, The First Time Manager. For those of you who may wonder why, when I have a we discuss a book, I not always, in fact, next week I will have the author, but I generally like to not have the author on, because the author's agenda, conscious or unconscious, is to flog his book, to sell his or her book. And whereas if Barbara, in this case, is the consumer of the book, she is reviewing it from more of a consumerist perspective and is more likely to simply share the points that she finds most valuable and to critique it. That's the rationale behind it, for what it's worth. Okay,
Before you go on from this topic,
sure.
I do want to say that your green light rule is very powerful. It comes to me frequently when I'm talking to someone and suddenly I'll think, whoops, green light, 30 seconds, have I gone on too long, and I'll stop.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, I do it on this radio show. I'm well aware. You will never hear, very rarely hear me go for more than a minute. I try, especially when I'm having, when I'm doing a little monologue, which I often do at the beginning of the second segment, but when I'm having a conversation with somebody, I try to keep my comments within the 20 to 40 second range. So it's more of a conversation and an exchange and a dynamic dialogue than any kind of series of lectures. Make sense?
Absolutely.
Let's turn to another one of the book. By the way, the book that Barbara has read is called The First Time Manager. And I don't remember the author's name, but we should give him or her credit. What is the author or authors of The First Time Manager?
There are three, Lauren Belker, Jim McCormick, and Gary Topchick.
Okay. That book encourages, and it's pretty cliched, but encourages what is the modern day kind of boss, which is a very collegial boss, that bosses are usually wiser to not boss people around, but rather to treat supervisees as colleagues, as equals. What are your thoughts about that?
I couldn't agree more. Number one, we assume that people understand why we got the promotion and they didn't, and that's not true. Very often when you are promoted, and particularly if you're in the same organization, you are promoted from one position to a higher one, people resent the hell out of you.
Mm-hmm.
They are jealous.
Mm-hmm.
They won't admit it. Sometimes they won't even admit it to themselves. But it's there, and if you don't recognize that, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stopping for a moment because I've gone 30 seconds.
Oh, I see. Okay, but let's get
and
to
then
the...
I'll say more.
Yeah. What's so... it's very easy to be collegial with someone you respect. If you're the boss and somebody is, a good performer, it's very fine to treat them with respect, listen to their input, give them flexibility, et cetera. But the real world is that not every supervisee is like that. Some are, are lazy. Some are not intelligent. They have gotten their job because of favoritism, or they've been there a long time and they were good when they started, but now they've burned out. They're excuse-making, they're backstabbing, there's all kinds of things. So it's all well and good to talk about a collegial style, but where the rubber meets the road is when a boss has to deal with somebody who he, in true honesty, does not view as anything near an equal. What are your thoughts about that?
But again, you don't want to be the person who is perceived as someone who just comes to conclusions too quickly and throws his weight around, because remember, whatever your dealing will be with that particular employee, that employee is going to tell 10 other people, and you can have your whole the whole view of you in the workplace poisoned by what this one employee says, which probably won't be true about how you dealt with him or her. So I find it far better to interact with that employee by listening first, by finding out what is the problem. I've noticed that you've had trouble completing your work. What's going on? Mm-hmm. That, to me, is collegial rather than you're not getting your work done, and this is not acceptable in this company.
Good point. It really does make a lot of sense to me. That actually leads into you. You talked about the fact that, listening is key. There's the old cliche that says you have two ears and one mouth, so listen more and talk less. And let's say that, I think we've covered that enough. Let me move off that. Let's talk about the fact that, in fact, especially weak employees are the ones most likely to badmouth their bosses. And you said that many times the worker is going to unjustifiably go and badmouth the boss to 10 other people. What are some other, does the book suggest anything to help ensure that there is trust, and other than listening, trust, positive relations, indeed respect, maybe even a certain amount of awe of their, maybe that's too strong, of awe for their, respect for their boss?
Well, I don't know that they particularly deal with it in that way, but one of the things that the book does talk about really well is if you have to terminate someone, because that's obviously the most difficult, most life-changing event that can happen for an employee, and very difficult for you as the supervisor.
Yep.
And the book says very wisely, if you do this right, the employee may thank you at the end. And when the employee thanks you, you know that you've done it right.
What is right?
How are you going to do that? Well, obviously, it's going to be that you've had ongoing conversations and you have treated them collegially, where you start off with going over what the expectations of the position are, which should be done, of course, at the annual review. And so the employee knows what they are, and then you review them and you merely very objectively point out what's the difference between the expectation and what the employee is doing. And again, that's when you shut up and listen. What's going on?
Let me try to flesh that out from my perspective. I'm curious then what you think or what the book there says about this. I think you're 1,000% right that if you create the foundation for trust by starting out when a new employee comes on board, and you say, and now I'm going to go over a minute, but it's more conscious because I think I need to provide this full context. When the employee comes on board, ask them about their goals, about their strengths, about their weaknesses, about what they hope to accomplish, and then you adjust the job description to match their strengths, you're more likely to set the establishment, the platform for success, and if things don't work out, still, there isn't going to be that antipathy. And then when crap happens, when they're not performing well, the notion is, the subtextual message is that it is not I am the boss being punitive, but I am going to sit on the same side of the table as you, not the opposite side, and say, okay, I'm perceiving a problem here, as you said. What can we do about it? But let's say that doesn't work, and continually, after a moment or two, there is a concern that, you know, the concern keeps coming up. Then what I think the critical thing to do is, and if you feel it is hopeless, and it's every management book says you should not spend too much time remediating your weak employees, you only have a certain amount of energy and time, it's far wiser to be working and empowering and strengthening your better employees and doing other things than working on your weak ones. So let's say you've made the decision the person needs to go to leave. Then the key is to not do the, in my judgment, at least to try, before you do the progressive discipline, you're on a 30-day notice, here's a, that is so oppositional and just leads to lawsuits, to counsel that person out, to take that person out to lunch and say, I'm feeling that maybe this is not the best position for you. You have these great strengths, A, B, C, D, and E, but this job is requiring F, C, G, G. Say we've talked about it a number of times, it doesn't seem to be sufficient improvement. I'm wondering if I could help you get a better job, either within or outside the organization. Doing that may not always work, but is far more likely to result in an employee saying thank you than if you do set the limits, these are the standards, here is the 30-day notice, etc. What do you think?
Absolutely. If you can counsel somebody out, that's the very best thing. But there are other things that you can do, because sometimes that same employee could do a different job in your organization that they might be able to do well, even if they can't do the job that they're currently assigned to do. And then there is the possibility that you know of other jobs, or you can suggest other industries or areas or people in the immediate area where the person lives that they might be able to look for employment. I think you're right. On the actual termination day, you want to be brief, but before that, you need to have provided opportunities for them to improve and given them some training and gone over the fact, how did the training go, made sure there was no problem between the person and the trainer, because remember, all of this could get legal. And once it gets legal, whether you're right or wrong, it's going to cost you a lot of money. You don't want that. You don't want it for the cost. You don't want it for the bad will that the employee will spread about your company.
I agree with it. But the subtle part is, in my mind, what I'd like to underline there is that you're on the same side of the table. This may sound like a weird word, but it's going to tie into next week's show. It needs to come from a foundation of love, as crazy as that sounds. It's not like, you know, here are these things, here's the things you need to improve. It's a human thing. We are in this together. We together are, we've been put on this planet, in this little part of the planet together, and my job is to help nurture, coach, mentor, whatever, so that together we can make us both happy and the organization successful, etc., so that it is really, really, really collegial. Does that make sense?
To an extent. You know, at some point, this it's going to hurt me more than it hurts you is bullshit, and they know. So it can't be totally collegial, because you're holding the power. But you certainly can be compassionate and in working in the interests of the employee, although not to the detriment of the company.
Yeah, of course, you know, I appreciate your colorful language. We use it all the time, but I'm not sure the FCC would be equally approving. Anyway, one other word of clarification you had mentioned. I just want to make sure the listeners don't take it the wrong way. You talked about being perceived as collegial. Of course, you don't mean, you know, a false perception of collegiality. You mean you want the employees to know that you are, in fact, collegial. You're not trying to create some illusion, right?
I cannot imagine being any other way. The notion of acting boss-like is so far from anything in my consciousness that it doesn't even occur to me.
Yeah, it's one of those sayings respect comes from earning it, not demanding it. You can't gain someone's respect by saying, I'm the boss, or bossing around. A tiny measure of fear is not a bad thing. Actually, that does tend to be a little motivating, but that's got to be quite subtly imposed so that, yes, when you've got to take a negative action, you do it crisply, without anger, but that can invoke a certain measure of fear, being crisp, being smart, etc. But in general, it's really critical to not be that way.
I don't think that people need to be fearful. I think just the position commands a certain amount of, call it fear if you want, I would call it respect. So I don't think you need to add anything to it. Your position carries that with it, and it's yours to lose if you act like a jerk.
Right. Beyond the fear, though, in terms of gaining respect, it comes, in my judgment, from you being you. You know, I know everybody, so many people believe in working not hard but smart, but really it comes from respect as if you're a person who's coming in early and or staying late. You know, you're going to gain respect. Think about how many times people praise you. They say, I can't believe, Barbara, you are out at meetings every night. That gains respect more than any other way. Or the fact that you stay calm under pressure when you're negotiating with the union, or you're negotiating with an angry parent or principal or two districts or the IRS. You know, the respect comes from the way in which you behave. Is that correct?
And I think all people in any kind of management role should try to model as much as possible the way they just generally would expect good employees to behave.
You cannot expect, if you are an employee, a boss, if you are yourself, you know, I know it's sounding Boy Scouty, but if you are not honest and hardworking and dependable and calm under pressure, you cannot blame it on the workers if they don't respect you. It's on you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. By the way, what else? You know, you and I swear on my life, I'm not trying to puff you up. But one of the reasons I have you on the show is because you are so often praised by people. You're called a role model as a leader and a manager. There was who called you a role model, and what did she call you? Why did she call you a role model, and what lessons does that have for all of us in terms of management and leadership skills?
Well, I had two people do that just the other day. One was partly because I've been around for a long time, and she remembers me from the 90s, but I was heading a statewide committee, and she was on it. And she just liked the fact that I was willing to take on the issue, work very hard to get it changed, and probably because I never am, quote, bossy or too full of myself. I think most of the time I am pretty self-deprecating, which is not an act, I just am.
Right.
And the other one was very complimentary because I'm blunt, like using words I shouldn't be using on the radio. and she said, sometimes I'm so afraid to just say things the way they are because I fear it won't be perceived as professional, but you do it, and it's so refreshing. I think one of the things that happens is we tend to get lost in our own jargon and our own gobbledygook. And when people are forced to listen to panel presentations and other presentations at meetings and conferences, it's enough to give you a really long nap. And so I generally try to wake people up by being more conversational and straight.
So let's talk about both those, because those are two huge issues. And I particularly like these issues because they are contrary to conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom is that managers and leaders should not be self-deprecating. Frankly, the women's movement have been really strong in encouraging women to not put themselves down. They say that's what's kept them from being successful. You have found self-deprecation absolutely critical to your success. You just said it, and you've said it many times to me before. Explain to me why self-deprecation, for women and men, is a wise thing to do.
Again, there is a certain aura that comes from having a high-level position. And then you want people to see you as the human being that you are, not the position that you are. I can remember a woman who was a college president who said she couldn't get a date because all the men were so afraid of her because she was a college president. That's crazy. You're still the same person. You just happen to have a very cool job. And so in order to relate to people, you don't want to go around with, I'm the head of this or that. You want to go around with, I'm Barbara, and this is who I am. So self-deprecation allows people to see you as a person.
That's
in
not,
my mind.
The Barbara who I am, saying this is Barbara who I am, is not self-deprecating. It's just not bragging. But you're different. Like you
no,
are on
see,
the
by being self-deprecating, it lets the Barbara person shine through, not the position.
But for example, you are on the state's technology committee, and by your own admission, and we can say it on the radio, you're hardly a techie, and yet you are a very respected person on the state's technology committee. Isn't that in part because of the two things you say? You put yourself down and acknowledge that you're not a techie, which, again, is violates the whole gender stereotype. You know, you're certainly around technology. You should not admit you're not a techie. And because you are obsessed with being super simple and practical and translating it, in, even though you've got a PhD from Berkeley, saying everything that you're going to say in the most human anecdotal terms possible. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Plus, it's so much better to admit your weaknesses rather than wait for people to figure them out themselves and think you're covering up.
Exactly. Well, that's the whole thing about any kind of a political cover-up. They always say the cover-up is worse than the crime. If you admit it up front, we screwed up, I need to move on, we move forward. Disclosure, right. If you tried to sell yourself as Miss Technology, they would be, is she really that good? And they would have discovered and you'd be a nightmare. You admitted it up front. So nobody's investigating that you're not a tech-savvy person. You're simply this good translator of technical stuff into plain English and common sense. Make sense?
And major advocate, because I see how powerful it is for kids.
Right.
When used correctly. So whether I can make it work all the time is not the issue. That's not what my job is. And that's the other piece. Remember, when you're the manager, nobody thinks you can do all the jobs of the people you supervise. You probably can't. You may not be able to do any of them because you weren't trained for that. So it's a different role, but you can be the motivator and you can be the person who advocates for and who sees the value and appreciates what employees are doing.
And dear listeners, note the implicit statement in there. Barbara says she is an advocate. That is her natural strength. She is her two biggest strengths. She is a natural advocate, both in one-on-one and in speeches. And so instead of trying to be what she's not, so she didn't go on to say, oh, my God, I'm really behind in technology. I need to take all these courses. She did a little, but not much. She said, I'm going to use my strength, which is advocacy, one-on-one and in groups, whether I'm talking to the government or I'm talking to techies. Using your strength is another way, coming full circle here, to become a respected manager and leader. Make sense?
That's all true, except for the part that I do take a lot of technology workshops and training. Sometimes they're over my head, but I do keep going.
Stand corrected. By the way, there, you know, my engineer, I really love that my board operator and engineer, Joanne Moore, listens so carefully to the show. She raises another question. She says, shouldn't you be really careful with the self-deprecation? Because it may work, but it doesn't, you know, other people are not used to that. And therefore, might your supervisees not respect you? You know, if you're putting yourself down, they think, well, she can't even defend herself. She's probably a real loser.
I don't believe that, because it gets back to all the modeling. When you are there after everybody else is and you're coming in on weekends and you're working hard and you're getting recognition for your good job, your employees, if anything, are going to be too respectful to the potential that they, depending on your job, can be somewhat in awe. I don't want anybody in awe of me. I'm the same jerk I was before I got
there. Who wouldn't love having people be in awe of you? Give me a break.
No. Respect, yes, that's all I want. But I think it's really important that you don't want people who, because they have this, sort of undue respect, over-the-top respect, or for the position, are then afraid to talk to you, to communicate with you. I have lunch in the lunchroom. Anytime I'm in the office, I have lunch in the lunchroom with everybody. And I am exactly the same as everybody in there, whether we're discussing our grandchildren or telling jokes. Mm-hmm. I am not one bit different, and I wouldn't dream of sitting in my own office because I can't mix with all the people I work with. And at all levels are in the lunchroom. We're all together, and we're all having a good time.
Yeah, crazy. That whole idea of an executive lunchroom is really exactly the wrong. It is out of the 1950s, and of course it makes sense that you'd be eating lunch with everybody else. Anyway, let's have some people join us in this discussion. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Barbara Nemko. The trigger for our conversation is the book, The First Time Manager, which Barbara read. But we're talking, as you can see, everything related to management and leadership. If you are either a manager, leader, or an aspiring one, if you have a question, a problem you're dealing with, we would love to take a shot at it. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, and boy, no sooner do I give out the phone number than the lines are lighting up already. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Marty and Barbara, good morning. There's something you're missing, and I think, Marty, it's because you're such a cool, calm, and collected character. I have never heard you flustered, and I've been listening to you for years. And the problem I have, and it's the same, it's the reason I can ramble in interviews, is nerves and nervousness.
Great.
And I feel when I'm in an interview, I just did a panel interview this week, and it's as though, if you remember those old game shows where you have like 60 seconds to gather as many things as you can, and the winner is the one who runs through the store and gets the most stuff or something. It's like you're trying to hit all the points, and part of it is memory, where they some ask you about projects, and you know, I got 10 jobs on there, and to try to hit all these points and do so and remember it. And I mean, you know, you might say make a list, but it's as though I'm standing in the middle of the street and an oncoming car blinds me with its lights. You can't see anything. It's that nervous.
Okay.
So I would just also add on that topic that one thing a good manager can do is to ease someone's nervousness.
Yes.
Not, you know, because we, the worker, I mean, at least I do, I'm always very respectful of their authority and so careful to not make a mistake that would disappoint them. But at the same time, I'm nervous.
Okay, great. Barbara, with your permission, I'd like to take this question, if I might.
Okay.
Okay. Constitutionally, I am not a calm person. I'm actually quite an anxious person by nature. But I have learned how to compensate it using the following buffet of strategies, and I'm wondering if one or more of them might be useful to you. First of all, the greatest antidote to stress is preparation. Before, you know, I've been doing the show 24 years, but you can bet your life that before every show, I am prepared. I've really done my homework, so that I know I've got a foundation of being prepared. I also do have a sense of perspective. I do recognize that there are 10,000 radio shows going on at the same time around the country, and most of them end up in the black hole of the radio, of radio shows past, and if I screw up, and I have, the world doesn't end. So I do have a sense of perspective. The other thing is, in an interview, you talked about the interview situation. If I were interviewed and they asked me a question, I can't come up with the answer. I can't remember it. And by the way, if I didn't have a good memory, I would probably have some notes in front of me. There's no reason why in an interview you can't have one page of notes or an index card to remind you of a couple of things. If you do have a bad memory, it will help you remember. But even leading politicians. Remember, even President Obama usually speaks with a teleprompter because he doesn't want to forget what he's going to say. He is if in a press conference he or his PR flack don't have the answer, the person doesn't answer the question. He simply deflects and goes and answers something he does. Or if he has to answer it, it's answered very briefly, very crisply, and except that not every answer is going to be great. You don't have to. You said you felt you need to be perfect. You do not need to be perfect to get the job. You need, you know, even in school, you only needed a 92 to get an A. You didn't need 100. So you can screw up on one or two answers, and the party is not over. So accepting that you do not need to be perfect, accepting that you don't have to have it all scripted and memorized, but being human, doing the best you can, having perspective. Oh, one more thing. Because I am not a calm guy, my heart would tend to race if I am, you know, if I'm nervous. Right before my doctoral orals, what did I do? I played basketball for 2.5 hours so that I was physiologically tired and therefore less likely to be adrenalized and my heart to race. So before an interview, an hour or two before, go exercise until you're, you know, tired, take your shower and then go. That's my buffet of suggestions. Is there at least one thing within that that you think might be useful for you?
Oh, yeah. I as far as the preparation goes, sometimes with some jobs, you can just get, and I tried to get information about it more than that was in the job description, but I just couldn't get it. So, I mean, I prepare as best as I can. And I would say and I've thought of doing index cards of different things I've done, but I never seem to get around to that. But you know, it's one thing I like about the Japanese culture. I have my best friend worked for a Japanese company, and I used to think he was overworked because it was like de rigueur to have to go out with the boss after work. So you're kind of not done work, then you have to go to dinner and drinks. But one good thing about that approach is you have time to get to know people and have a conversation. And an interview, it's less of a conversation. I was peppered with 9 questions and had about 25 minutes to give answers, and it was very hard working with a panel. I felt like I was in a tornado. So I do like to have more of a conversation, but, you know, the interviewee doesn't get that choice.
Well, you do get some of that choice. To some extent, there are some very bad interviewers, and especially in highly regulated or unionized environments, it is required to give exactly the same questions to everybody so that there's no chance of racism, sexism, etc. But even in those structured situations, it's very important that you try to... Before they get to that formal part, if you can be human, be the human being you are in the conversation and in your tone and in your body language, etc., it can sometimes, not always, sometimes encourage the interviewers to be a bit more relaxed. I was interviewed recently. I was at Berkeley Adult School. They want me to do some work for them. And they were, they were firing questions in the beginning, but I was... very human and very relaxed, and then asking them questions in the middle to dishumanize experience. And as the interview went on, the formality, which they had prepared questions ready to go, they dropped that formality, and it was a much more human interaction, and yes, I got hired. So I would invite you to realize that even in the most structured situations, you would be wise to make sure you bring your humanity to the situation, because you can subtly... sometimes affect how it transpires.
Excellent, and Happy New Year to you both.
Okay, you're welcome. Barbara, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, there was one.
Please go ahead.
I thought I heard implicit in the question was that when he gets into these interview situations, he kind of hears himself going on and doesn't quite know mm-hmm. how to stop. Mm-hmm. And what I would do for that is I would just bring one card, not a whole bunch of note cards, one mm-hmm, card, mm-hmm. and it would say something like green light rule or just stop now. And I would say after my reasonable, say, 60 seconds worth of time, let me stop now and ask if that's what you were looking for, or is there a different direction you wanted me to go in, just to give them a chance to say something.
Oh, I like that a lot.
Okay. That's great. So just a few points on one index card, and keep it following the traffic light rule, keeping it brief. So I'm delighted that you like Barbara's idea.
Me too.
I want to thank you very much for the call.
To you too.
Yep. I'll give you the. I wonder what day the New Year, the Happy New Year starts. We're now at the 26th of January, and I'm 27th. Excuse me.
31.
Yeah. And at what point you think February 1st is when you can stop saying Happy New Year?
That's my rule.
Okay. We'll give out the phone number one more time. If you have a question or comment about being a manager or a leader, we'd invite you to call. We'll try to be of help if we can. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Barbara, there's a... we've been throwing around the term manager and leader. Does the book, and the book is called The First Time Manager, does it address at all what the difference is and how to go from one to the other, or not really?
Somewhat. I think as a manager, your job is particularly to make sure that the people who report to you are getting their work done. As a leader, you are responsible for setting the direction and getting everybody on board together as a company, not just individual sections, but everybody moving in the same direction and understanding the mission of the organization. So they're a little bit different.
So in a word, the word is the leader has a larger proportion of his or her role is to inspire. Is there any guidance either in the book or that you would like to suggest on how to be inspirational?
You better go and take some public speaking classes. Communication is key, absolutely key. And although you can be inspirational in quiet one-on-one conversations with people, there is something about getting everybody together in a room and talking about where you're going and also to be inspirational, you have to be appreciative. If you inspire people and they work harder and try harder and you never express appreciation for the fact that you've noticed that they've done that, what's the motivation to keep doing it?
What do you think of this? It seems to me the key to, even if I were not a great public speaker and I, you know, let's say I wasn't using a lot of appreciation, you know, to gain that inspirational quality. But what if I talked about the criticality of putting our work in a larger context? Let's say my work was, couldn't be more mundane. I was the manager of a soybean processing plant and creating tofu. And I'm dealing now with my workers who are, you know, shelling the soybeans and putting them in the machines and just looking to make sure that there wasn't chaff put, you know, in there and packaging it and all that. It's pretty mundane stuff. If I, however, especially with a new hire, but also in a team meeting, reminding my employees that nothing is more foundational to life than sustenance and healthy sustenance, then tofu is one of the healthiest foods of all. And to ensure that that every person, the thousands and thousands of people who will be eating our tofu, can confidently know that it is clean, healthy, and worthy is among the most important work that we can do. And so by putting it in a larger context, it helps every employee to feel very valued. Do you agree that that's a key part of inspiration?
Absolutely. How would you do that?
What do you mean, how would I do that? I would say that's exactly what I would say at a staff meeting. If I was, let's say I was working, I'm thinking of making it as difficult as possible. I'm a manager of a funeral of a cemetery, and I'm meeting with my supervisees who are ditch diggers. I would say something like, you know, our heroes in society are rock stars, our politicians, our actors and the like. And they get all the credit and they get all the money. And here you are in what admittedly is not the most pleasant place in the world. And your job is simply to dig ditches. And yet you continue to do it. You come in day in and day out because you realize it is a necessary job. You are more of a hero to me than all those rock stars and politicians who get all that money and all that praise. Because the work needs to be done to honor, to help the honoring of the deceased's life and help the necessary, the funeral, etc., the burial to occur without a hitch. And so I want to let you know how much I respect and appreciate all of you for that. That's how I would do it. That, to me, it's that kind of a statement. And then not just saying it, but then treating those dish diggers with respect by getting them raises where I could, with praise and thank yous, by walking around, not just sitting in my office, certainly not an executive office. I think that's how I inspire. Any suggestion, any comments on that?
Absolutely. I would add to that we are dealing with people who are at their very worst. I don't mean the deceased, I mean the family.
Right.
And that when we, in doing our job, show respect, and we don't always know when people are around, even when you're digging ditches, suddenly a funeral procession goes by or somebody's coming to visit someone else's grave, the fact that we are doing our jobs in a respectful way really changes the experience for the people who are grieving. And as you said, was walking around and saw somebody being particularly respectful or doing something nice, that's the appreciation part, pointing it out, saying,
yeah,
thank you. I noticed that you were very kind when the lady asked for directions or whatever it was. Pointing it out, showing appreciation, I think is key.
I think that's a great point. I think there's a corollary to that, which is to expand the job description of such a person. Somebody who's a ditch digger deep down doesn't want to just dig ditches. So if I can, wherever possible, train them, for example, in customer relations and how to deal with people in these difficult situations, and calling them the CEO of that particular part of the cemetery, and that, you know, they are critical to that, and offer them some training, formal or informal, asking for their advice. Maybe they're just ditch diggers, but I say, you know, we have a big decision to make about how to allocate funds for whatever. You know, I really know that the people who are on the ground, literally and figuratively, have a lot to say about that. I'm curious what your opinion is. That's another way to inspire. You agree? Are you there?
Yeah, I suddenly lost you.
Oh, okay. Did you? Well, I don't know. Anyway, let's just.
No, I heard you. Then there was just a couple of seconds of dead time. Absolutely, that's what being a collegial manager is. It's talking with your employees about what it is that the group is trying to accomplish, asking their opinion, taking their input where it's valid and relevant, and always being part of that team.
Yep.
I'm not sure I would call them the CEO of anything because they're not getting paid like a CEO, and I think that could be misinterpreted as being either sarcastic or disrespectful. But I would certainly say that their job is hugely important to how people feel when at the worst time of their lives.
All right. I want to give out the phone number one more time. If you if you've been listening to us or you've just simply got a career problem of any sort, especially related to either your being a manager or your own manager that you're dealing with, or trying to make that move from up the ladder, so to speak, from individual contributor to manager, manager to leader, I welcome your call. And we can certainly do what I call a 3-minute career makeover. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Does the book, again, the trigger for this conversation that we've been having is a book called The First Time Manager. Does the book offer any suggestions for the wisest way to hire so you do have an employee who's easy to manage, lead, and you're unlikely to need to terminate?
It does. It says that we always look for experience, we look for specific technical skill, but the most important thing we should be looking for is attitude.
Right.
Because you can teach people some technical things, you can teach people, you can give people experience, but if their attitude is no good, no matter what else they can accomplish, they can absolutely sabotage their own job.
I am so amazed all the time. You know, for the last 50 years, every book that's ever been written on management talks about the fact that you should hire for drive and intelligence, and you can train on knowledge. And yet, almost all employers insist on hiring based on experience. It is so crazy. Why do you think employers do that so much?
Because they haven't read the right books.
I think they cover in their butt, and it just somehow feels easier.
It seems intuitively like that would be important.
Yeah, it seems like, and also it's just clearer. It's less arguable. You're not going to get fired for hiring somebody who's got 7 years of experience doing exactly the same kind of work. You hire somebody who doesn't have the experience, who's, you know, you intuit, has intelligence and drive and a great attitude, and it's subjective. And so it's harder to defend your decision with a higher-up. And also, it really does, then, whenever you're subjective, then there can be much more subject to accusations of, you know, sexism, racism, etc., when it's subjective. But if you say, oh, this person has 7 years, or this person has a bachelor's degree, that's cut and dried. So they tend to, you know, it's a less risky approach to hiring, even though it's a less valid one. Make sense?
Absolutely. And it breaks my heart that we use degrees.
I know, it's crazy.
The screening tools, because there are people who don't have degrees who are fabulous at
right.
their jobs, and they can't get promoted beyond a certain point because they don't have the piece of paper. And as many of us know, that piece of paper doesn't guarantee anything.
And ironically, there may even be a negative correlation. Somebody who's really great doesn't need to have a lot of piece of papers to justify they immediately, in an interview and on the job, they prove that they're great. Somebody who is not really good in the real world continues to get more and more pieces of paper so that they know that the foolish employers will value, oh, this person has a PhD, this person, you know, has a master's degree, when in fact that may in some cases be of value, but very often what you learn in those PhD and master's programs are certainly not the most beneficial way to spend one's time, those 4 to 6 years, compared to learning it in the real world. But we digress. Let's go now. Our lines are all lighted up. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Hello?
Yep.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question. So I'm a real estate agent, and my business has just really been picking up over the last couple of years, and I'm feeling really seasoned, and I'm getting more and more referrals, and I'm starting to consider building a team, and I brought in one person already to help with my business, and I'm struggling with delegating, because over the years I've been so used to doing so much of what mm-hmm. I do every day on my own that I'm struggling with trusting the chores, so to speak, and passing them on to this what might be my team in the future. Can you talk about delegation?
Fabulous question. Love that you called, Barbara. You want to take it? Or you want me to take it? It's your call, your decision.
Well, let me start, and then you'll fill in.
Great.
I think it's wonderful that you recognize that you're having trouble with it, because too many people don't and therefore delegate nothing, and then nobody feels like they're part of your team. I guess one of the things I would do is look at the whole range of things that I'm doing, and then as I'm hiring these additional people, I would work with them and have them help assess the areas in which they feel strongest, which might give you a little more confidence that you can delegate particular areas to people because they have great expertise.
Okay, I want to add two things. First of all, very often the fact that you're not trusting is a symptom. Not always, and I'm going to ask you, symptom that you haven't hired the right person. Doing a great job search, you will find somebody who can do that work really well so that you can trust them, don't have to think about it. Is that the problem, or are you just a micromanager?
I'm more of a micromanager just because that's been the pattern of my business for the last 15 years.
If you've hired a good person, if they are really good, let's even grant that they can't in the beginning do it as well as you. If you micromanage them, they're going to be frustrated and they're going to quit, and their motivation is going to be decreased. You have to realize that you're going to make an investment. When you hire them, you have an obligation to do some training so that they can learn from your experience, and then realize that your micromanaging is going to hurt your business, hurt them as human beings, and therefore you must pull on ropes of restraint and back off. Does that make sense?
100%.
Okay, I thank you for the call. We got all these lines lighted up. Let's go right back to the phones.
Well, I just suggest that there may be in these new hires people who are better at some of those areas than you are.
Yep, could be. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that my mother used to say to me was that people hire people that they want to work with, meaning it's something, it's a connection that you make in an interview.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that you can't go to an interview and have all the bells and whistles, be a nice person, interview well, and not get the job just because there's just something that doesn't click.
Right.
And that's something that I think people, interviewees and interviewers, should sort of give themselves some slack on. And the other thing is...
Before you go to the other thing, you know, it seems to me that the way you can increase your chances dramatically of being liked and of creating connection by being, and this is going to sound a little odd, being a chameleon. We all have different sides to who you are. I am, at my real core, an introvert intellectual. That is who I am. But if I'm going in an interview, it's showtime. And I'm going to bring out the other side of me, not just the other side to be necessarily energetic and enthusiastic, but I'm also going to be very non-narcissistic. I'm going to look and listen to the other person's characteristics. Are they intellectual? Are they emotional? Are they long-winded? Are they quiet? Are they informal? Are they formal? I will flex to meet to be as much, while still remaining authentic, I will bring out the part of me that is consistent with who they are, so they are more likely to have that ineffable connection. Does that make sense?
It does. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Barbara, any comment about that?
Total agreed.
Okay, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. What is your question or comment for either of us?
Hi, this is Alvin in Berkeley.
Hi, Alvin.
Does this book that you were talking about address sort of the Peter principle about people who, you know, maybe they shouldn't go to another level?
Yeah, good point. Barbara, does the Peter principle is you rise to your level of incompetence. Does the book address that at all, about how we know when up isn't, whether you shouldn't move up? Some people should be thrilled to be individual contributors or first-line managers and shouldn't aspire to leaders. It's a great question that Alvin asked. Any thoughts about that, either from the book or personally, your reactions, Barb?
It is a great question, and the book, I don't know whether you would say deals with it. It certainly mentions it, that you need to kind of do an assessment of yourself and determine if management is really what you want to do. For many people, the notion of having to spend their days kind of overseeing the work of other people and all the interpersonal I'm having a senior moment.
All the personal skills required, yeah.
To spend your thought process on all this interpersonal communication is not something that everybody wants to do. There are some people who are just much happier working on their own with minimal interaction, and if they have that kind of a position in the company and they're doing really well in it, they may want to consider whether they want to take a promotion when it's offered to something that's going to be very different.
Right. Alvin, you know, the American traditional way is that up is the only way. It's hierarchical.
Yeah, I know.
And yet, in truth, if there is a theme that undergirds this show, I think anybody who's listening to this show knows that I have as much respect for the dishwasher as the CEO. In fact, in some ways more, because they get paid less. They're doing work that is not respected. And so it is critical to look dispassionately at where will you bring the most good to the world and to yourself. For some people, it is as an individual contributor. For some people, it's at the head of a nonprofit. Some people are somewhere in the middle. That's why career counseling, that's what is so important. It is helping people find what cosmically is right for them in the world. So I'm going to personalize it to you, though. Alvin, are you having a dilemma about yourself?
No. In my own life, I'm semi-retired. I was a well-educated scientist, and I worked, did some heavy-duty stuff way back. But the thing is, I saw that they were going to expect me to become a group leader, and there was no training about that. I wasn't going to be able to create a new project for a bunch of other people.
Right.
And I had to go into another line of business.
No, we got to end here, but I do, you know, for any of you who want to become, I have been obsessed with this topic. It helps something I work with my clients about all the time. I wrote a couple of articles, one called The World's Shortest Course in Management or something, and it's also a key part of my book called How to Do Life. So you might want to look at those. Barbara, we are just about out of time. But I want to give you one overall softball question. Is there one other thing in the book that you want to very briefly tell us that you think our listeners should know?
Well, I just want to actually reiterate what our last caller said. He mentioned training. It is amazing how you can get promoted to a job where you're now going to be supervising because you were very good at what you did and nobody gives you training. Run as fast as you can. Ask for training.
And there's tons that's available.
It's a whole different skill set.
There's training. There is so much available in articles, books, webinars, etc. You don't need to go in and get an MBA on how to be a leader. In fact, you probably won't learn how to be a leader from that. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco for this week. I want to thank my very good listening, as always, Joanne Marm, my board operator, and, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers, and I will talk with Dr. Mark Goulston on heartfelt leadership. Do you really need to be a viper to make an organization successful? I also want to thank you again, Barbara Nemco, for always being my my very favorite guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Thanks so much, Barb.
You're very welcome. Good thing I am.
Yeah, we'll see you in a little while.
Bye.
Okay, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.